employee retirement system, and we're going to open public hearings on House Bill 2978, 2979, 2980, and 2981. And we have a representative from the governor's office who has an appointment outside the Capitol and needs to testify first, so we'll call Margaret Heller.
Thank you very much, Chair Knopen, members of the committee, and thank you particularly for taking me out of order. I don't have written testimony today, but I just wanted to say a few words about these bills that are in front of you today. We have serious reservations about these bills, and wanted to let you know about those reservations. We think that they're counterproductive and will not cause labor relations to go any more smoothly in this state, and in fact could be the end result could be quite disruptive, and believe that over the next few years labor management negotiations are going to be fragile enough in the state of Oregon because of the many changes which have already been enacted and the economic climate and times. And we feel that further that the best place to resolve the remaining issues is at the bargaining table, and that we should not make further changes to the collective bargaining statute. So I wanted to just alert the committee to those concerns and let you know about those concerns early on in the process.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much for coming down. Why don't we call John Marshall and Ron Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association, and we're appearing before you this afternoon in support of all four bills before you. School board members throughout Oregon are charged with the responsibility of, by the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act, of bargaining with their employees and their employees' representatives when asked to do so. There are 198 school districts. Of those 198 school districts, 178 have contracts with their licensed and classified employees. Simple math would tell you that that means that there are over 350 collective bargaining agreements in place just in those school districts. That does not include 21 ESDs or 17 community colleges, many of whom have two or more collective bargaining agreements with various employee representative groups. We believe that the bills before you will make the existing collective bargaining process smoother, more streamlined, and less expensive. We have some written testimony that, in which we've outlined the provisions of the four bills as well as our rationale for support. Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'd like to have Ron Wilson, OSBA's Director of Human Resource Development, take you through those bills, and then obviously be glad to respond to any questions you might have.
Okay. Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Ron Wilson. I'm the Director of Human Resource Development at the Oregon School Board Association. Thank you for taking the time to hear our testimony. Collective bargaining costs both time and money for school districts. And to be certain, the Collective Bargaining Act does provide for protection of rights for public employees, and that's important, but it's not free, nor is it inexpensive. The commitment of time, money, and resources to this endeavor is significant in school districts. Just the amount of time that it takes is also significant. House Bill 2978 proposes to reduce the amount of time from 150 days to 75 days, and then with a proportional reduction in the interim bargaining process from 90 days to 45 days. Well, typically, how long does it take a negotiations to occur? It's really not atypical to spend over 100 hours in negotiating a contract spread out over about 200, 175 to 200 days. Some Negotiations have taken quite a bit longer. The Portland negotiations, of course, that made a number of headlines in the paper, that took about 8 months, 240 days. Lincoln County, a couple of years ago, in their negotiation took 898 days. And there's a number of other districts in the state that are spending a year, 360 days, 350 days, 370 days, to negotiate contracts. The longer those contracts go, the more time, money, energy, and resources are provided to those activities. One of the things that we've observed, of course, is that protracted negotiations can also lead to more labor management conflict. But those delays, just in and of themselves, because it takes anywhere from 9 months to 12 months to get through the process, those delays itself can indeed cost money. For instance, there is a statute which is actually addressed in House Bill 2979 that creates a public policy to grant merit step or longevity increments as part of a status quo obligation. In other words, an obligation that occurs if you haven't negotiated a new contract, but your old contract expires, you start the next school year, you're required by that statute to give automatic step increases. That creates a situation where just by delaying in bargaining, you can increase your costs. It also creates a dynamic. And if I can just move a little bit to House Bill 2979, we certainly are faced with the situation now, particularly when school districts are having significant financial difficulties, when we propose salary freezes, step freezes, freezes on benefit contributions. It does create a situation where the only thing that the union has to do is delay bargaining, and they will get those step increases. And particularly when faced with the situation where their best case scenario might be that all they can get is step increases, their best strategy is indeed to delay. But we do end up having to question the public policy implications of a statute that does grant these automatic increases at a time when we are having such difficult financial situations in the state. And those step increases are not without cost. To an individual teacher, on average, it's about 3.87% to their salary. But not all teachers are eligible for a step. Actual cost to the district is anywhere from 1.5% to 2%. House Bill 2980 provides a fail-safe provisions to protect services and taxpayers if there is indeed some type of unexpected revenue shortfall. One of the nightmares that school districts have gone through over the last year is that every 3 months we have a new economic projection that is indeed lower, requiring the district to continually revise its budget and to make cuts on cuts, and ultimately to, on the basis of our survey, 90 school districts are reducing or shortening the school year in order to save dollars just in 2002-2003 school year. This particular bill sets up a situation that if we do have an unexpected revenue shortfall, you can go ahead and trigger the renegotiation of that agreement. Because if there's one thing that we have learned out of 2002 is that we really can't guarantee raises or benefit increases to employees, or in some cases even hiring new staff under all circumstances. So we need some type of fail-safe mechanism, and we think that this bill provides that that fail-safe mechanism. The last bill is House Bill 2981 that prohibits coalitions of labor unions, bargaining councils, under the collective bargaining statute. Certainly one of the fundamental parts of the collective bargaining statute is that local school boards should be able to deal directly with their employees. Local associations of employees should be able to deal directly with their employers. In other words, those who are most directly affected by the labor agreement should be the decision makers. And we believe that bargaining councils just creates another layer that doesn't need to be there. Have any questions?
Where is there a single place where all collective bargaining agreements are collated that somebody could look at them if they wanted to?
Yes, we have a contract library at the Oregon School Board Association where we have actual copies, some hard copy. We try to get as many electronic copies of contracts as we can.
But you guys have copies of everything in all the school districts, including ESDs? Or
including ESDs and community colleges. We are constantly trying to get the most recent contracts. For instance, some of the most recent settlements in the last 3 or 4 months we haven't received yet, but we'll try to get all of them.
Are those just available to your members, or are they available to the public? Or
they would be available to the public under a public information request, yes. If you would like copies of specific contract language, we'd be more than happy to provide that to the committee.
Thank you. Questions?
Chair?
Representative McPherson.
I put this question to both Mr. Marshall and Mr. Wilson. They can choose to both respond or either one of them. This is the Committee on the Public Employee Retirement System, so I'd just to editorialize a little bit, I was a little surprised to see these bills coming before us because it seems to be outside of the expertise that we've been building up here over the last several months. But drawing on that experience, the financial difficulties that you refer to in public finance in the state has led us to take some actions that significantly impact the statutorily required benefits for our public employees. Given that situation, it seems to me that the collective bargaining rights are really the last protection that our public employees have. That is the ability to present their case at the bargaining table, and yet we have a set of proposals here that seem to change the landscape significantly for collective bargaining. Is this the right time to be, after in the wake of the decisions that have already been made that impact on our public employees, to be bringing this package forward that remakes that landscape in a way that I think is quite a bit less favorable to the bargaining process?
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I don't normally testify, so I'm not sure of the protocol. But I think it's Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson. The changes that are incorporated in these bills talk about changes to the bargaining process itself. It doesn't necessarily dictate any particular result. Really what the bills are doing is referring those decisions and those results back to the bargaining process. The first bill, 2978, talks about making the bargaining process more efficient for both parties. We even have a couple of agreements that have just come out now that are talking about providing those provisions in the Collective Bargaining Act itself. In other words, the parties are agreeing already. For instance, in Tillamook, Northwest Regional ESD is two examples of saying that, yes, if we have to reopen, we're going to do it. We're going to do it in a 30-day period. So by providing a process that's more efficient, I think it will actually help the parties. In the second bill, by modifying the statute on step increases, et cetera, that refers that back to bargaining. So that part is, I think, also supportive of bargaining. The third bill, 2980, does the same thing. All of the triggers on the economic shortfalls triggered back to bargaining. It doesn't necessarily dictate a particular result. So I think that is also supportive of bargaining at this point. So I think that the bills are responsive to changes that are needed because of the economic situation. And not all change comes at a pace that we would like. But I think these changes are necessary.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Mr. Wilson, would it be a fair generalization to say that all four of these bills change the landscape of bargaining in a way that is less favorable to public employees?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I think I would disagree with that. It does change the landscape, but I don't believe that it necessarily changes the landscape to the detriment of public employees. It does change the rules, and it makes the rules more efficient. but it doesn't prejudice, I believe, public employees within that process itself. It does force both parties to be more efficient.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You complain that it takes too long to bargain a contract, and then you want to double that time by saying any kind of economic, whatever it was, the economic emergency, which isn't really well defined. You go back to negotiations.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I don't believe that the effect of House Bill 2980 would be to double the time. Just to give you a little bit more detail on a couple of the examples that I used. In both the Tillamook licensed agreement and the Northwest Regional ESD agreement, both parties agreed to a process that if indeed they have to shorten the school year or there's some other type of financial exigency, that they will conduct bargaining and they'll do it in a 30-day period. So just because there's necessarily reopener doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be for a long period of time. And I think that's one of the things that House Bill 2980 does, is it forces the parties to talk about what happens when we do have a repeat of 2002. Or if we have an appropriation to schools, that in the end we don't end up getting that much money because of the worsening economic situation.
And this applies to all public employees. It doesn't just apply to schools, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so if I may.
You may.
You have a system working there, so people are agreeing to do that. I don't know why we need to impose that on everybody else.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, that's really the first time that I've seen these types of agreements. They are being responsive, I think, to the financial situation. But I think there is an advantage for being able to say that the fundamental bedrock on which these collective bargaining agreements are addressed provides these types of provisions, so that's then applicable to all. Not all agreements come open at the same time. They do vary in length. This provides, I think, a much more direct and positive tool that the parties can use to refine those problem-solving solutions at the bargaining table.
In my experience in Portland, there was times when the city would say they had no money. And one year I recall, I was part of a negotiating group that settled for zero, and then right after that they found, I'm not sure, I'm going to surprise everybody, millions of dollars. But so should times improve, then should the unions then have an automatic reopener for more wages? If the economic times improve, should we make a law covering that? It's kind of just the other side of this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I would absolutely love to be in a windfall situation so that we could provide additional services to children. I frankly don't think that's realistic. At times, however, in collective bargaining agreements, like a number of other areas, I do see some windfall agreements, and those do occur. But on the other hand, I think what we're faced with right now is an economic situation that we have to be responsive to. Windfall situations, I think, frankly, are maybe some wishful thinking. I'd certainly like to see them.
Well, then you just, if I may, are you just proposing this for a very short time until the economic turndown turns around and then we won't need these anymore?
The bills don't address how long these particular statutes would be in place. And I don't believe we've addressed that that particular point.
In the economic shortfalls, if I may, another thought I have came to my mind today. Suppose in Portland, Commissioner Eric Stinn decides to give lots of money to Dignity Village to keep that going, and not to the street cleaners and not to the police, fire, meter maids, whatever. Is that an economic shortfall then that would trigger new negotiations because the city could say we don't have any money, we gave it to somebody else?
And Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Barker. I'm not that familiar with City of Portland bargaining. My experience is coming out of the state and with school district bargaining, so I'm not entirely familiar with their system there. This particular bill, I believe, talks about a revenue shortfall, not an allocation or expenditure shortfall. Again, that's somewhat based on the perception of the person that's receiving it, of course. But it is a revenue shortfall. So on the basis of your question, I would say the answer would be no.
I'm having some of the same concerns that Representative McPherson did. This seems to just be, you know, stacking on right now because we're in tough economic times to really just change collective bargaining, which we did quite, or the legislature did. I wasn't part of the legislature then. In 95 was Senate Bill 750. I mean, they essentially, from the employee perspective, gutted collective bargaining in Oregon. That seemed to work somewhat fairly well here the last few years. Thank you.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Wilson, I appreciate the fact that you're concerned about being more efficient, and I see how some of the bills might do that. As I look at House Bill 2981, I'm wondering, maybe there's a reason why this can happen, but wouldn't it be more efficient rather than doing away or prohibiting a coalition of local labor unions in these eight bargaining councils? Would it be better to have a coalition of school districts that would represent all of the schools in the Southern Oregon Bargaining Council and enter into agreements that would cover that region rather than trying to break it up so that each one has to have separate negotiations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, while I'm not an attorney, some of my attorney friends have indicated that such a coalition of employers would probably not be supported by the current statutory structure for boards in this state. I'm not that familiar with all of the legal ramifications of that, so I probably can't address your question as specifically as I could. But one of the observations, I think, is that it's been our experience that better decisions are made at the local level. And what this concept is takes it at least one step, or perhaps more than one step, removed from that local level. So even on the basis of just kind of a public policy perspective, these types of detailed decisions, I think, are best at the most local level, not on different steps removed. So I would probably argue that even a coalition of school boards at that level is probably not the best way to approach it, because it should be a local decision.
Follow up? I understand that, and I'm a local control person, excepting that I'm confused as I learn more. I get more confused at how properly local school districts can function when they have no authority for determining the amount of funds they will have, but they have full responsibility to negotiate and enter into collective bargaining agreements and in the expenditure of those funds. And so I see it's a very difficult thing. In fact, when I was on a budget committee years ago for School District 6, it took me two sessions to figure out that it was all perfunctory, that we were going through budgetary meetings in March and April because it had to be done, but the school district actually didn't know how much money they were going to get until June, and the school district had the authority to make changes of up to 10% of anything that we came up with in the budget hearings, and nearly 90%, between 80 and 90% of the funds were primarily going to be dealing with collectively bargained issues anyway, and so it really was going through the appearance of having budgetary hearings. But in reality, once the final numbers came down as to what the school district was going to have to spend, then there was final decisions made by the school board as to actually how much money was going to get spent and where it was going to get spent. And so there's even discussions of going to statewide collective bargaining. If the state's going to control the purse strings, is it realistic to have every school district be entering into collective bargaining? And our committee has been focusing on PERS, and so we really haven't got into this too deeply. But I'm asking the question because I can see where you're coming from in the desire not to have a coalition determine on one side and then individual school districts on the other. but I don't know if we're really going to be able to address the reality that there's difficulties for each school district in having to carry the responsibility for all of these things when they have no authority over how much money they're actually going to get. I mean, it's part of this system that I see and that I'm not involved in trying to help solve, but I'd sure be interested in any comments either of you might have.
Mr. Chair, but Representative Richardson, that's an issue that we've dealt with since Measure 5 passed. The primary source of funding has in effect shifted to the state, but yet there are 198 school districts making individual decisions based on the values and attitudes and needs and circumstances of those different communities. So the question is, how do you balance the legislature and its fiduciary responsibility to ensure that this five plus, we hope, $1 billion that you allocate to schools goes to where you think it ought to go? And against allowing local citizens in their own communities to determine what their schools look like and the programs and services they provide to best meet the needs of their constituencies in those 198 communities. And how do you strike that balance? Some have suggested, well, if the legislature is going to provide the bulk of funds, then we ought to do the collective bargaining. Well, that obviously takes a major shift away from that local decision-making process. We believe that allowing local citizens to sit down with their employees and their community and work out agreements relative to salaries, benefits, and conditions of employment works well. What we're suggesting here is that we believe we've identified some ways to, we believe, can make that more efficient, streamlined, less expensive, burdensome, and cumbersome. But the debate about the balance between the legislature and individual school districts and who pays and who spends is a debate that's gone on and will continue to go on. And obviously the issue of statewide bargaining or a statewide salary schedule or more state control is a debate that could probably take more time that the committee today is willing to allocate to it, but it's a discussion that we're willing to have.
Questions?
Chair.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wilson, I'm going to switch gears just temporarily and focus a bit on House Bill 2979, which is the bill about prohibiting merit step and longevity step increases during bargaining after the expiration of the current contract. You suggested in your testimony that unions and professional associations might use current law to as a basis for dragging their feet in negotiation in order to get step increases. And I'm not aware of instances of that happening and would interpret good faith bargaining to mean that that's not something that they should be doing. But since you suggested it, what would prevent an employer, if this bill passes, from dragging its feet in order to withhold step and merit increases from its employees?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, one, the provision of good faith bargaining doesn't necessarily prevent delays. In fact, there is an old saying in collective bargaining, what's a foot for if not to drag? One of the things that I've found is that delays, depending upon which side of the fence, so to speak, that you're on, can either work to your favor or not, and you're either trying to push quicker or you're trying to slow things down. What I think this bill does, however, is it takes away a public policy statement that grants automatic pay increases. And what the effect of that would be is it puts it back in the bargaining table, which is probably where it should have been, should have belonged in the first place, and allows the parties to make an agreement or not on that particular issue. And that's what I think that this bill really does, is it throws things back into the bargaining process and really does level the playing field, but it does take away that public policy automatic increase issue.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. But Mr. Wilson, these step increases are already in collectively bargained agreements. So the collective bargaining process has already taken place. So I don't understand you're wanting to put it back into collective bargaining when nothing exists in an agreement that hasn't been collectively bargained.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, that's part of the point that we're making, is that this as a statute imposes that on a collective bargaining agreement when that collective bargaining agreement doesn't necessarily address that issue. For instance, in most collective bargaining agreements, there are no provisions that talk about what the obligations of the parties are under the status quo. Now, given the financial circumstances, we're starting to see agreements that start to address that particular issue. An example is the Northwest Regional ESD agreement that does prohibit those granting of steps during that status quo period. So even if there isn't any provision addressed in a collective bargaining agreement, this statute provides that new floor. What I think the bill does is it levels that floor and says that it is going to be a subject to pay raises or bargained raises.
Taking a switch in line of questioning, if I might, Mr. Chair, although one brief response. First of all, what I hear you saying on that is that these step increases are now in collective bargaining agreements. That means they've been collectively bargained, and you're advocating that we take them out of a collective bargaining agreement, and the legislature, that is not your local school board, should dictate how those should happen for all 198 districts. But now I want to switch gears again to follow up on some of the questions that have already been raised about your efficiency argument. First of all, you make a point that collective bargaining might require as much as 100 hours over the course of 200 days. By my calculation, that's about 5% of a full-time, year-round operation. And I keep hearing that personnel costs represent 75% to 85% of school districts' budgets. So just as an introductory comment, investing 5% of your human resources time in something that covers 75% to 85% of your expense seems actually pretty efficient to me. And yet, the question I want to ask you is that you support the bill that cuts the time limits down. That would be bill number, House Bill 2978, because you want this to be more efficient. And I'd like you to square that with your support for House Bill 2981, which I think you could argue provides some efficiency, because if you allow coalition bargaining, you have fewer than 198 negotiations going on, you could save some time for local school districts. Those don't seem consistent to me, and I'd like you to square them up for me, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, a couple of comments, I suppose. The devil is always in the details, and there's different levels of complexity. For instance, it's not just that your calculation of 5%. There's much more time and energy devoted than just the 100 hours. It's 100 hours of all the people that are involved, board members, administrators, etc. So it is a very significant amount of time, and it's not just the collective bargaining, the negotiations. It's contract administration, providing all of the support for those activities, etc. And so it's not just a mere 5% that goes to support the 88 or 85% of school district funds and budgets. And secondly, bargaining councils, I believe, actually make the bargaining process more complicated and less efficient because, number one, just because there's a bargaining council doesn't eliminate the local education association. It's been in my experience when we bargain with bargaining councils, we're not just bargaining with the council, we're also bargaining with the local education association. And when the local education association, theoretically representing the bargaining unit, comes to a TA, a tentative agreement, yet that tentative agreement then is rejected by the bargaining council itself, and we have to go back and forth, that I think makes it more complicated and in fact less efficient. So it's actually not less bargaining with bargaining councils. I think there's more bargaining with bargaining councils.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson, you're the human resources director for OSBA. I take it that in that job, you advise local school districts on collective bargaining and on negotiations, and I think I've read in your bulletins that you provide specific services to help them negotiate. Although you don't call yourself a coalition, it seems to me that by having an association of employers, you serve in very much the same function of a coalition for the employers in negotiating, and particularly I would think for some of your smaller members who don't have full-time human resources specialists, don't have lawyers on staff, don't have the capacity to provide that. You provide that. So why do you think it's fair to do that and then not let the employees do the same thing of pooling their resources?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, the Human Resource Development part of the Oregon School Board Association does provide negotiating services and consultation for school districts. Sometimes that's just consultation on the telephone. It also that means that we will represent school districts at the bargaining table as their chief's spokespersons. And there's three bargainers on my staff, including myself, or in addition to myself, that provide that service. But we don't represent all of the school districts in their negotiations. They also have a number of private attorneys, other labor consultants that provide that service. We do that for about 45 to 50 school districts in various areas, or excuse me, in various different levels, from at the table to just telephone consultations. And when we provide service to a local school district, because part of the association's philosophy is local control, we're not representing OSBA, and we don't have a statewide bargaining policy per se. We're representing the local school district, and we're representing that local school board. We're providing the negotiating parameters for that particular negotiation. So we try to do exactly the opposite of what a coalition would do, is that we try not to bring an outside agenda to a local negotiation. And so that's part of the philosophy, per se, of the local control implications to the services that we provide local school districts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Tricia Bozak, can you bring somebody with you?
This is a coalition.
What's that?
She bring a coalition.
Coalition of two. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Tricia Bozak, representing the Oregon Education Association. We represent 44,000 certified and classified members throughout the state in K-12 and also faculty and staff at the community college level. We are here today in opposition to all the bills before you today. They are not new concepts. Many of these, as has been pointed out, were discussed and discarded in the 95 session and negotiations over the last major change of the Collective Bargaining Act, Senate Bill 750. Also, some of these ideas fell by the wayside and were discarded in 1977 session and Senate Bill 650. So three, at least, are not new concepts. Also, House Bill 2980 that deals with seems to be a reaction to the current fiscal condition that we face. And as Representative Barker alluded to, We are concerned about some of the implications it would have, even though it tries to address the current fiscal situation. It would be part of the Collective Bargaining Act for all time, and we have some concerns with that. We wouldn't want to open the way to any American Airlines type situations in school districts or local governments throughout the state. So we see all the changes as either impractical or unnecessary, and I think primarily if you read the preamble to the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act, it assumes a balance at the table between employers and employees, and we feel like that these bills upset that balance. And so to deal with the particulars of that, I'd like to introduce you to our bargaining coordinator, Diane Trank, who is an experienced bargainer and has been at many bargaining tables and has taken a look at these bills and can talk about some of the particulars of those. That's all right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to take a few minutes to talk briefly about each one of these bills that are before you. But again, I want to reiterate something that is at the heart of the Collective Bargaining Act in Oregon, and that is ORS 243656, which is the policy statement for the PECBA. It recognizes that peaceful labor relations is facilitated by, and I quote, establishing greater equity of bargaining power between public employees and public employers. This balance has been talked about already during this hearing, and it's an important piece of why we oppose all of these bills that are before you. House Bill 2478 reduces bargaining time. First, it reduces the bargaining time during interim bargaining from 90 to 45 days, and then during regular bargaining from 150 to 75 days. I'd like to talk first about the interim bargaining. Currently, the 90-day interim bargaining begins when the school district gives notice to the association that they want to open the bargaining on a particular issue. The association has 14 days to respond to that announcement, but the 90 days includes those 14 days. So the actual bargaining time is already shorter. These 90 days already give an unfair advantage to the district because they can do research on an issue, they can discuss it, establish a position, bring it to the association, and all of that research has to be done by the association within these limited 90 days. To do all of that within 40 days or 45 days seems unrealistic. I'd like to present a specific example of where this could be truly problematic. Let's say a school district notified the association of intent to bargain under this provision on July 1. 45 days later is August 15. The entire bargaining process would take place while school employees, primarily in teacher units, would be away for the summer, with no opportunity for them to be part of the bargaining program to be properly represented at the local level. So I see this as being very problematic. It's also problematic to reduce the 150 days of bargaining. That's already a very short time to deal with the complex issues that the parties must face. It isn't just about funding. It's also about the other provisions of the contract, which are being complicated for both the district and the association by the ESEA, or the No Child Left Behind Act at the federal government, many provisions of which are about to become subjects of bargaining in every district in the state. But the real practical answer to why we're opposing this is that whether or not a local and a district can reach a bargaining agreement has less to do with timelines than it has to do with good faith, which has already been mentioned. The ability to reach a peaceful settlement is really dependent upon that good faith. As a matter of fact, Section 2 of the proposed legislation provides for a set period of time for good faith negotiations. Frankly, where there is good faith between the parties, the timelines are not going to rule the situation. The parties will take as little or as much time as they need to reach a peaceful resolution. These timelines only become important where there is bad faith on one side or the other or both. Then they become weapons to bludgeon the other side. And if parties are looking for, a party or both of them are looking for excuses not to bargain, the reduction in the timeline simply makes that the number of excuses they need to not come to the table. Frankly, if you really wanted to do something to perhaps make bargaining more efficient, it might be to impose upon the parties a minimum number of hours that they must come together. Frankly, if the school district was willing to promise us 100 hours at the bargaining table talking in good faith, I'd be willing to shorten the timelines even further. But in reality, that doesn't always happen. And so timelines are not the answer. Timelines will not solve the problem. Timelines will not change whether or not the parties enter into this process in good faith. And I think you need to keep in mind, although Mr. Wilson talked about a few school districts that bargained for a long period of time, the reality is that each year there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 to 100 contracts bargained in school districts, and the vast majority are bargained without ever going to mediation or into the turmoil that was faced in the few districts like Portland. And so we hope you don't change everything because of a few bad examples. Moving on to House Bill 2979 about the merit and longevity steps. I think you need to understand how these merit steps, as the bill is calling them, get into the collective bargaining agreements to begin with. When we started bargaining in the 70s, school districts simply could not afford to pay all of their teacher a contract wage, a professional wage. And putting steps into the contract was a way to save school districts money, that year by year, the teachers would little by little, because of the experience or years of service to the district, they would gradually move up to a professional or contract level salary. And that whole concept of experience steps is what we're really talking about here. That experience step for the last year of a current agreement is earned inside that year under the terms of the old agreement to prevent the teacher or any member of the bargaining unit from taking that step the next year would be to deny them a benefit they already earned the previous year by working for the district. It's an earned benefit, and it shouldn't be taken away from them. It should indeed be automatic because they earned it under the terms of the previous agreement. House Bill 2980 is the measure that deals with unexpected revenue shortfall. Obviously, this concerns us because it does dramatically upset the balance between the parties. I have bargained for a long time, and part of that process is analyzing school district budgets. When districts come to us and say that they don't have any money, that may or may not be true. And an important piece is for the parties together to stop, analyze the district's budget, have discussions about what the resources are, and then come to some kind of mutual agreement of how to move forward. If one party can make a unilateral decision that they don't have any money, and the other side doesn't agree, the problem may be solved immediately because the district may do something in response to being able to open the contract or to implement their last proposal. But it won't really solve the problem because it will appear again the next time the bargaining takes place. Where parties can't reach mutual agreement about what the situation is in the district, it never gets resolved. So I think that's an important piece. And in point of fact, if a district can indeed unilaterally just declare that they have a financial emergency, then it does not give them a lot of motivation to spend their money wisely as possible. If they can spend any way they want with no accountability to anybody about how much money they should be putting in to maintain a quality teacher staff, I think that's a problem. And so we would be very concerned about the shift in balance that would occur if the districts could make these kind of unilateral decisions. And then we also have practical problems. What if there is a disagreement about whether or not the district meets the conditions or terms set up in the statute? Who resolves that dispute? And how long will that dispute take before bargaining can get back on track? I think this will delay bargaining and make bargaining more difficult. It certainly won't provide an atmosphere of trust between the parties. House Bill 2981, the Coalition of Labor Organizations. I think a piece of the problem is, again, understanding what these labor coalitions are, or what they really are bargaining councils. I was involved with the bargaining council for a very long period of time in the area around Eugene. There are 14 local associations that have combined together to create the Lane Unified Bargaining Council. If you think about it, the districts in our states, in our state, are range in size from a Portland, where the association has approximately 3,200 members, to some small school districts. There are 8 members of the local association. Bargaining councils are about small locals coming together because they don't have the resources on their own with 15 members or 20 members or 30 members or 70 members. They simply don't have the resources inside their own association to do all of the work it takes to come to the bargaining table. And so bargaining councils were put together to help that process, to help small locals deal with the magnitude of the work connected with bargaining. And they've worked successfully, and they haven't interfered with bargaining. Local people are always on the local bargaining team, talking directly to local school board members, and should be allowed to continue. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regards to all public employees, teachers, the records, clerks at the police station, the firefighters, police, everybody, you're saying this would be more disruptive, you think, to the collective bargaining process than is now in effect. You think that'll have it would seem to me, I guess I shouldn't even ask the question, this seems to me so obvious this would be really detrimental to the morale of the public employees. I mean, they're kind of framed this for just for teachers today, but it's much broader than that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I believe that's true. Again, it's about balance. The parties have to come together feeling that both of them share the ability, power, if you will, to come together as equals and negotiate what is best for all the parties involved, including the people that they service, whether it's students in a school district or whoever they're providing service to. I do see these as disruptive. I do think the bargaining law right now in the state is already working well. We have very few, I mean, the last strike that occurred was a number of years ago. Most settlements are reached peaceably. Just in the last year, more than 70 local associations agreed to open up their contracts to make concessions on salaries and so on to help school districts that were having funding problems. The process is working. It isn't broken. It doesn't need to be fixed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mary Botkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin with AFSCME Council 75. We represent public employees across the state, and about 22,000 of them. We have 140 locals. And I want to kind of walk through our perspective on this, because we handle bargaining certainly differently than the school board people do, and I think in a little less contentious manner. And I don't know who Ron or whatever his name was bargains with, but my experience with working with OEA in some of the bargaining has not been similar to what he's talking about, so I don't know who he's talking about. But let me just kind of walk through how we handle ourselves. 2978 continues to do some of the things the 750 did, which was to impose kind of artificial timelines on the bargaining process that doesn't acknowledge that the bargaining process is about give and take and coming to agreements, not coming to disagreements. Many of our locals have adopted the process of using what we call collaborative bargaining, which means that you come to the table and you discuss things on an ongoing basis. And in the spirit of collaborative bargaining, you don't have any timelines. You don't have any time frames as such. It is an ongoing process. It can be very exhausting because it feels like you really kind of never stop bargaining with your employer. But what it does is over a period of time, it creates a very strong working relationship with your employer, and you find ways to resolve issues without having to deal with, without having to go to grievances or, you know, other more aggressive manners in which to resolve your problems. And so, you know, we just don't think that it makes a lot of sense to kind of unilaterally say, okay, we're going to create these time frames that you have to be finished by, and if you're not finished, well, then you have to go on the next step. Well, people may be very close to an agreement and not ready to go on to the next step because there's some kind of an artificial timeline there. They have to or they lose their rights. That makes no sense to us. You know, I think that there's another complicating factor here, and that is I've been sitting in on the herb budget, and we just cut the herb budget fairly significantly. And in the testimony, the employer reps in that sit on herb were saying that part of the problem is that we're going to lengthen the hearing timelines and the hearing delays, so that when there is an issue that needs to be resolved and you need to go to herb to get it resolved, even if you and your employer are, you know, amiably saying we just don't agree, let's go get a ruling, now the herb budget has been cut in a manner which says it's going to take us even longer to get there. So, you know, this is, you know, whether it's a ULP that the employer files or that we file or whatever, you know, now you're talking about, you know, having an artificial time frame in there that herb can't even hope to meet. So that's a problem, and I think it just makes resolution more difficult. And with all due respect, it feels a bit like people who, you know, folks who do bargaining in a successful manner probably ought to be talking about how to do collective bargaining laws, rather than people who seem to, I mean, Ron just didn't seem to be able to talk to his employee reps, and that seems unproductive to me, and we don't have that problem. 2979, Representative Barker absolutely brought out the right issues, and that is, you know, there's processes in place that says if you're dragging your feet at the bargaining table, you're guilty of an unfair labor practice of bargaining in bad faith. It's against the rules. It's just that simple. There are penalties associated with it. I can't imagine a union dragging its feet just so their employees would get a step increase. That makes no sense to me at all. Under the most contentious circumstances, it makes no sense to me. No union would ever want to be found guilty of a ULP for that kind of bargaining in bad faith. I mean, if you're going to get charged with a ULP, you might as well have it mean something and not dragging your feet. 2980, reopening on, based on economic downturns, it's not a problem. We do it all the time. You know, if the employer comes in and says we're going to lay off 300 people in the city of Portland, you know what? We sit down immediately and say, let's talk about this. Let's figure out what's going on and figure out solutions. But I think that, again, Representative Barker put his finger on this pulse, and as did Representative Nolan. The only time we came within a hair's breadth of going on strike in the city of Portland, it was over issues that that both of those individuals, that you two both alluded to. Vera decided to give all the money away. She built the Esplanade. She built PGE Park. She gave money to schools. And then when we went to the bargaining table, she said, oops, no money. You know what? This is not okay. You know, we don't have any problem. If you want to give all your money away, that's fine. But don't tell us you're broke when it's our turn to bargain. And, you know, this is a process which is fraught with potential problems of our employers acting in bad faith, of saying, you know, we're just not going to give it to you. We're going to give it to somebody else. I mean, we talked about Dignity Village. That's not where we gave our money. We gave it to a baseball park. We built a walkway. You know, probably the best money that we gave away was to the schools. But that, you know, I mean, this makes no sense to us. And, you know, instead of holding on to enough money to pay the salaries and to take care of her own employees, she, you know, she turned around, she closed local police stations, and she laid off community policing staff. And, of course, the first people who went were the folks who were in the communities where we had the biggest need for community policing. In those communities that were had a lot of gang activity, those are the first places that we cut back. Made no sense to us at all. 2980 just, in our opinion, just gives her it just gives irresponsibility the right to continue. And that's not okay for us. 2981 eliminates coalition bargaining. We think that's a great idea. We've been trying to figure out a way to get out of DCTU for many years, and you're just making it illegal for us to be in it. And the city of Portland can bargain 9 contracts in the city of Portland instead of 1. And as the big dog in the room, we'll do better. And I look forward to watching the city of Portland bargain for 4 plumbers and 7 electricians and 25 sheet metal workers. I mean, this will be a lot of fun for them. Or we could just keep doing it the way we are. Now, I will tell you that in some of our rural contracts, we also do coalition bargaining. Because, quite frankly, there's a big community of interest in some of those rural communities, and we come together in a way, in a manner which allows us to save some money, save some time, and get to an agreement to meet everybody's needs. And I don't know what happens with the state of Oregon. I don't know whether that's considered coalition bargaining or not. I mean, we have a central table bargaining where we bargain for every state agency that we represent. So does this mean that we bargain for each agency and that within the agency we bargain for each prison and that we bargain for each worker? I mean, I don't know how that works. But I can tell you it's not going to be efficient. And, you know, we may have our problems with some of the ways that bargaining goes some of the time. But, you know, kind of unilaterally making changes like this doesn't make a lot of sense to us. And we think that bargaining should not be contentious, but ought to be collaborative as much as possible, and that we should save the battles for the big issues and not kind of create unnecessary work for people. I just can't even imagine how anybody would have the time to do the work that would need to be done under some of these bills. And I can't imagine what the school boards are thinking, but clearly those people have a lot more time than our people do, and I bet they have a lot more time, or they seem to have a lot more time than anybody that I know over at the Education Association. So maybe we should just cut back on their staff, since they seem to have so much time that they want to just spend it all on bargaining, because we don't have that much time. So maybe we could make some changes there and save some money over on their side and put it in the schools. In the classrooms, maybe. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you, Mary. Speaking of coalitions, Rob Wagner, Tricia Smith, you want to come up together? Michael, do you want to testify? No? Okay. Is there anybody else want to testify? No?
Good afternoon. I'll be brief. Rob Wagner with the American Federation of Teachers, Oregon. We represent 10,000 public employee members, faculty at higher education institutions, faculty in classified community colleges, and classified K-12. We're in opposition to all these bills. I'll focus my testimony primarily on House Bills 2979 and 2980, which we feel tilt the table toward management. It also poisons the bargaining environment. In terms of the first bill, 2979, Merit Steps, currently, as I read the current statutory language, nothing prohibits mutual agreement to freeze steps pending a next contract. And if you look at the actual language of the bill, it talks to this, that it says in line 10 on page 2, that unless the expiring collective bargaining agreement expressly provides otherwise. So there is an option at the bargaining table to provide for freezing of steps. But what the effect of the bill is to actually statutorily prohibit steps. And it's interesting that Mr. Wilson's testimony said that this doesn't dictate a result when, in fact, that's exactly what this bill does. And it takes it away from the bargaining table when he said it puts it at the bargaining table. So we're obviously in opposition to this bill. The one other point on this is the problem of retroactivity. If we throw steps and parties agree to new language, the employer would then have to go back and recalculate the effect of increases during the time the steps were frozen. We actually had a situation with our PCC faculty in the 1980s where they actually had steps frozen despite the fact that it was in the collective bargaining agreement that steps would be honored. And they sued and won on an unfair labor practice claim. And employer had to go back and then recalculate the additional earnings that would need to be provided to our members consistent with the bargaining agreement. Just finally on House Bill 2980, there's nothing that prohibits reopeners or agreement to reopen in a collective bargaining agreement in times of financial exigency. I'll say the financial exigency is to become my favorite term of the session. And I'll say, you know,
you need a dollar for that word.
Yeah. I think that was one they put up on the board in honors English in high school, if they still offer honors English, I'm not certain. And I'll say that, you know, because of the current shortfall, we actually have several contracts that could be reopened, or this has been, the employer was successful in getting this language in there. So again, I don't know. I just say that this already happens, and I also have trouble with the fact that in the bill, the language "unexpected revenue shortfall" is not clearly defined. So there's given a lot of open interpretation over what could mean unexpected revenue shortfall. And then I'll just sum up by saying, The final two bills, they don't directly affect our folks. I mean, I think the timeline piece has been well stated. But in terms of the process, I think that these bills are a poison pill. I think that if we really wanted to sit down and talk about changes to collective bargaining, then, you know, we'd be glad to sit at the table. But especially given the nature of what's happened in this legislative session, we just have real trouble in terms of the process with people late in session coming in and trying to force through some bills like this. So thanks for your time.
Why don't you go ahead?
Representative. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. We're a public sector union having about 20,000 employees or members in K-12 community colleges and ESDs throughout the state. And we also are opposed to all of these bills. I know it's
all
a shock. Every single one. We tried to find one we liked. For all the reasons that you've heard from the people who have spoken in opposition and also perhaps a couple of others that we may have thought of, I will try to be brief, although you made me talk, so I think I probably will finish. We negotiate approximately 50 public sector new and successor labor contracts each year. And on average, our union is involved in 10 expedited collective bargaining negotiations each year that modify or add new language to an existing contract. This legislation, House Bill 2978, we believe is counterproductive. If the goal of the public sector collective bargaining law is to provide a structure for labor and employers to reach a mutually agreed contract on wages, hours, and other terms and conditions of employment, it takes time for agreements between parties with conflicting interests to be accomplished. Artificial timelines for completion of the collective bargaining process will not produce faster nor better agreements between the parties. It will only produce a more contentious setting in which to try to make agreements. Today and prior to the changes in the collective bargaining statutes in Senate Bill 750 that introduced the timelines, employers and unions could declare, and they still can declare, impasse anytime they want to in this process. If they believe that the parties can no longer negotiate productively, they can declare an impasse and an employer can implement its offer. Timelines are detrimental to the collective bargaining process, in our opinion, if the goal of the process is to come to a mutually beneficial agreed to bargaining agreement. Implementation of the employer of their last best offer does not produce a positive relationship between labor and management in the workplace. It only, as I said, produces contention and low morale. That's the reason why, although public employers can implement contract provisions now, it's rare. They can now, but they don't because it's rare, because it doesn't produce the desired result. That is a mutually agreed to agreement that they can then move past and go back to work. Everybody wants to go back to work and educate kids, not sit at the bargaining table. The issues don't go away in a contentious setting. They just simmer until they become bigger and bigger and bigger. We have fairly, we would say that we have fairly reasonable and productive labor relations in Oregon in the public sector. We see no reason to add bills to this process that will make that more difficult in a time when, for reasons that none of us brought to us, it's difficult enough to come to these agreements. Also, our members feel that these bills are a fine way to thank them for coming to the table often, as they have in the last year or 2 years, and in some cases longer than that, to help employers try to stabilize their budgets and try to manage their budgets in a reasonable way. It's difficult for our members to do that with their employers and then have bills like this come forward that appear to be motivated by a sense that they are not doing their part or not doing their share, which they feel that indeed that they are. House Bill 2979 is an interesting bill because merit pay and longevity pay schedules are not the first choice of labor. They were put in place, as I think someone else said, to allow employers an opportunity to work into market rates, market wages for their employees. What labor would prefer is to have an introductory wage for a new employee followed by a market wage for that profession and no steps in between, because the initial wage should be your training wage, your starting wage when you're beginning with an employer. After a period of time, you've shown that you know how to do the job, you should be paid the market rate for that job, instead of waiting 5 years and sometimes longer for the employer to eke you up to that market rate. For the employers to now say that they don't want to pay these step increases when they have already been negotiated for these people and earned by these people is inappropriate in our opinion. If they don't like merit raises, if they don't like step increases, then we think that we should go to a market rate for wages and skip the 5-year lead-in to the actual wage, which is the top step. House Bill 2980, we don't get this at all. I'd like to know what the definition of unexpected is in this bill. Is an unexpected revenue shortfall the one from this special session? Is it the one from last week? Or is it the one that we all knew was coming 10 years ago or 12 years ago after Measure 5 hit? Unexpected is a word that we could argue for a really long time. If I thought that we were actually going to move this piece of legislation through this process, I would ask you to please work with us to find some real definition for the word unexpected, because we would argue that if you're expecting money from the legislature, I think money is unexpected right now. So unexpected is an interesting word in this process. We see this as merely an opportunity for employers to get out of agreements that have been fairly bargained and agreed to by employers and employees. There is no point in collective bargaining and good faith bargaining if one party on the other end of it can say that they didn't expect what they are receiving. House Bill 2981 affects, we don't have bargaining councils at OSEA that we are working at the moment. Again, we don't see a need for this bill, as Ms. Botkin, I think the city of Portland is the perfect example for why bargaining councils are a good idea. It would be an unfortunate situation when one of those 9 unions did not come to agreement and went out on strike and the whole city shut down, even though 8 unions had agreed to their contracts, and that would be the result if there were no bargaining council that holds everybody to it. So again, we don't see any of these as productive. We don't see them helping the process of labor management negotiations. We don't see them as helping educate our kids. We don't even see them as helping getting us out of this building. And so for all those reasons, we hope that this is the last time we see them on the schedule. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Thank you. Anyone else wishing to testify? Brian.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I couldn't resist. Given my batting record in front of this committee, I'm a little afraid to let you know that all of my clients are against all of these bills, but as is the case with most baseball players, they hope at some time to break out of the slump. I would hope that this is the case where I finally break out of the slump in front of this committee and these bills get buried in. With that, I'd answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions? Thanks. Anyone else wishing to testify? If not, we'll close the public hearing on 2978, 2979, 2980, and 2981. And I believe that completes our agenda for this particular meeting. And we may or may not meet on Thursday. Still working on Senate Bill 325. We may do that Thursday or possibly next Tuesday. So with that, committee's adjourned.